idea is to take all the money you spend in corrections and move it over and spend it in other strategies.
Reimagining the state's criminal justice system. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, June 4th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a state employee who received a layoff notice talks about the budget impasse.
It's a game of chicken is all it is, and it's ridiculous. It's a make or break situation for a lot of people.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. And by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977.
A spokesperson for the Senate Majority Caucus has been arrested for a hit-and-run accident in the parking lot of the Anchorage Legislative Information Office. 38-year-old Press Secretary Carolyn Cookertz has been charged with three felonies and a misdemeanor for allegedly striking two people while under the influence. The arrest occurred on Tuesday at around 5:30 p.m. According to court documents, Cookertz quickly backed out of a parking spot at the Anchorage LIO and hit 28-year-old Mara Selenak, leaving her on the curb in extreme pain. Selenak suffered swelling and bruising to her torso. She was taken to the hospital and was released with no major injuries. Cookertz was also allegedly struck another woman on the leg. Witnesses say Cookertz initially stopped, was asked to stay, but then responded, "I can't." The Anchorage Police Department says Cookertz was later located at Minnesota and Benson, where she was picking up her daughter from daycare. Officers noticed the smell of alcohol, but were unable to complete field sobriety tests because Cookertz was swaying and stumbling. Her blood alcohol level was later tested at 0.21, more than twice the legal limit. Cookertz is currently being held on $10,000 bail. She pleaded guilty to a previous DUI in 2010. A member of the Republican Senate Majority Press Office says she's been placed on administrative leave without pay. Alaska's criminal justice system is expensive, ineffective, and unsustainable. That's the hard truth shared by a group of legal experts on the Alaska Criminal Justice Commission. Commission members are visiting Nome seeking input on ways to reform the system. KNOM's Matthew Smith has more on the reforms residents in Western Alaska want to see.
The 13-member commission includes a diverse group, from judges and attorneys to state agencies and mental health specialists to Alaska Native and victims' rights advocates. The commission has 3 years to make recommendations to the state legislature on reimagining Alaska's law enforcement, courts, and incarceration systems.
They needed to come up with new thinking, new ways of doing business, because they can't afford to do it the old way anymore. It's too expensive. It's too expensive to just build prisons and throw more people in jail.
Greg Razzo practiced law for more than 20 years and is an Alaska Native representative on the commission. With 2 out of every 3 offenders expected to reoffend within 3 years of their release, the big idea is justice reinvestment.
The idea is to take all the money you spend in corrections and move it over and spend it in other strategies, such as treatment programs.
Mary Geddes is an attorney with the commission. She says treatment and other efforts that would reduce the high rates of rearrest demands a hard look at how the state runs its prisons today.
We have questions about whether or not this is a good use of our incarceration facilities, that it's housing nonviolent offenders, that it's housing so many people on a pretrial basis. That means people who have not been found guilty are still sitting in jail waiting for the resolution of their cases. And that it's housing people who essentially have substance abuse disorders. Is that a good use of that expensive resource?
The response from the audience at Coerics Rural Providers Conference yesterday in Nome was a resounding no. Elders from the region told stories of, quote, all their kids being in jail, of grandmothers on fixed incomes, housing and feeding their grandchildren as sons and daughters found themselves arrested and rearrested and brought to hubs like Nome or Anchorage to serve their jail time. Kodiak elder Irene Coyle joined a chorus of speakers calling for local solutions.
We have troubled adults and teens, and they're being taken away from the village and they go to the cities. I just see that's very expensive. I think with the tribal being where they are now, need to be more stronger in the criminal justice so that we can deal with our own people at the villages and continue to find ways to discipline their actions and be responsible and accountable.
That system is expensive, costing about $58,000 a year for every prisoner on a hard bed, alongside huge costs like the $240 million Goose Creek Correctional Center in Point McKenzie. Already filled to capacity at the state's current rate of incarceration, Alaska would need another multi-million dollar prison in just 3 years. Advocate Keith Morrison of NOAM says spending that money on local justice systems is a better idea, but he says the state can't walk away from the current system without paying for something to take its place.
There will always be costs. The question is, do you want costs to be an investment and on the front end and stemming these problems? Or would you rather be reactive, like the justice system, and only pay for it on the back end and it not be at the community level? There needs to be a reallocation of funds so that the same amount of money that went into this broken system can be reinvested into the communities to build the community system.
Another speaker from Koyuk urged commissioners to go out to nearby communities and not end their trip in rural Alaska in NOAM. The commission can make regular recommendations over the next 3 years before delivering its final recommendations by February 2017. In NOAM, I'm Matthew Smith.
A lot of unhappy letters are arriving this week at state workers' homes. KTOO's Elizabeth Jenkins followed the state layoff notices from the mailroom to one worker's mailbox.
In the state office building's mailroom, it's almost the end of the day. Jeremy Duncan and a coworker are running letters through a postage machine. He's been a mail courier for about 12 years, and he knows one of those white envelopes might be his.
Layoff notifications, and I'm sure that I have one in there too, unfortunately.
There's a clock on the wall that's ticking closer to 3 p.m. That's when the mail goes out.
We're waiting for a stay of execution type of phone call, as it feels like.
The phone call doesn't come. At 3 o'clock, several boxes are loaded onto a cart and wheeled to the mail truck. In total, the state spent over $6,000 on sending the layoff notices, something they were contractually obligated to do. About $3,000 went to Anchorage, $1,100 to Fairbanks, and $3,000 to other places. $2,500 were sent in Juneau. And it's all because legislators haven't agreed yet on a fully funded budget. At Schweitzer Village, Sierra Kendrick opens her mailbox with a key.
Got what appears to be the layoff notices for me, my partner, and couple pieces of junk mail. I really just hoped that, you know, they would figure it out before it got this far.
She works for the Alaska Department of Commerce, and her partner works for the Department of Transportation. She had a meeting at work and knew the letters were being sent out. And she's heard some of her neighbors are avoiding the mail.
They just don't want to. They'd rather wait and till we hear something, and, you know, they send somebody else to check the mail so that they don't have to see the letter.
If the legislature fails to pass a budget in time, a small number of workers could still come back, but there are a lot of unknowns, and layoff details vary by department and division. The one thing that is sure, the government will be operating next year with less funding. Kendrick says it's been a stressful and confusing time for her family.
Going, okay, am I going to have insurance come August? We've got two high-needs kids that rely very heavily on our insurance, and we can't afford to go without it.
State workers' last day could be July 1st. The health insurance will last through the end of the month. After that, they won't be covered. Summer was supposed to be a special time for Kendrick and her partner.
We are planning our wedding in July, and that's kind of been put on the back burner because those are expensive.
She says thankfully they've already bought her partner's dress, but they're still trying to figure out how to pay for everything else.
You know, we're budgeting for it, but there's only so much you can do. We may just have to reevaluate what we want to do and downsize.
The day-to-day expenses, Kendrick says, would be difficult to manage if they lose their pay. They have two car payments.
Cable, internet, you know, we may just shut it off for a while just to save the extra $150.
With the legislature's budget negotiations still ongoing, she says she's tired of lawmakers waffling.
It's a game of chicken is all it is, and it's ridiculous that a group of adults are playing a game like this. To them, there is no consequence, but to everybody else, it's a make or break situation for a lot of people.
For now, all her family can do is wait until a budget is passed, or isn't.
It all depends on what pretty little pieces of paper we get in the mail and when they happen to get here.
Kendrick says she's currently looking for other employment. In Juneau, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins.
The legislature's budget conference committee is scheduled to meet tomorrow. Former University of Alaska executive Jim Johnson of Fairbanks has been put forward by the UA Board of Regents as their choice to be the university system's next president. Prior to work in the private sector in recent years, Johnson served in several high-profile positions at the university, including chief of staff to former University of Alaska president Mark Hamilton. Johnson is currently a senior vice president at Alaska Communications. A release from UA Regents says Johnson was selected from a group of four finalists by a search advisory committee that included regents, faculty, staff, students, and UA Foundation members. It says Johnson will meet with stakeholders in Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Juneau over the next month, after which Regents will review feedback and make a final decision. If hired, Johnson will succeed retiring UA President Pat Gamble in August. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, training a rescue dog who's great at finding victims and needs just a little work on another skill.
And then we do the obedience, and that was our hard part because being named Pace, she can't stay still.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. Many Alaskans who die in boating accidents don't die of hypothermia. Without a life jacket, drowning kills long before hypothermia does. More at pledgetolive.org. This message sponsored by Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
The U.S. Army has decided to base 9 Gray Eagle drones at Fort Wainwright. The Pentagon announced it first to Alaska's congressional delegation, which issued a joint press release this afternoon. The unmanned vehicles are about the size of a Cessna and similar to the Air Force Predator drones. It's good economic news for Fairbanks. The delegation says 128 military personnel plus family members will begin moving to the area next month. 120 firefighters are battling a wildfire south of Kalskag that started Sunday from lightning. It's grown to 14,200 acres. 4 water scooping aircraft are attacking the flanks of the fire as crews work to build a perimeter. They've put in a water pump near an area of heavy timber. Tim Mowry is a public information officer for the Alaska Division of Forestry. He says there are no structures at risk now.
But we're just trying to keep the fire on the refuge so it doesn't spread to native lands and native allotments.
The fire is about 3.5 miles from the nearest point of the Kuskokwim River, burning in tundra grass and black spruce. Fire officials have enacted a temporary flight restriction to keep planes out of the area. While the fire grew quickly this week, Mowry says the weather has improved.
We get a little bit of precipitation and I guess some even hail on the western flank of the fire, and that helped out, and the winds have died down a little bit.
He says the fire was not as active today as it was earlier in the week. Northeast of Tulaksac, a fire in the Bogus Creek area has grown to more than 8,000 acres. No staff is on that fire, but aircraft are dropping water. Statewide, 31,000 acres have burned so far this year. The North Pacific Fishery Management Council will likely recommend some significant changes to the current version of the Magnuson-Stevens Act, but not during its meeting in Sitka. As KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports, council members have concerns over amendments that would exempt fisheries decisions from the National Environmental Policy Act and open the door to potentially biased science.
The Magnuson-Stevens Act is a huge law. It spells out the management of all fisheries in the United States that occur more than 3 miles offshore. Magnus and Stevens created the North Pacific Fishery Management Council and the seven other regional councils that set the rules and regulations around the country. It's no surprise, then, that council members would take an interest in H.R. 1335, the reauthorization of the Magnus and Stevens Act, which just passed the U.S. House of Representatives, sponsored by Alaska Congressman Don Young. And other politicians have taken an interest as well.
This issue seems to be dragging down support for H.R. 133 at the presidential level.
This is Council Executive Director Chris Oliver referring to President Obama's recent letter threatening to veto Magnus and Stevens, since the House bill substitutes a new set of environmental standards for fisheries decisions in place of the standards used under the National Environmental Policy Act, or NEPA. NEPA is an important law, too, in its own right. It's the reason we have environmental impact statements for major decisions regarding the country's resources. Oliver told the council that he's been working for years on streamlining the NEPA-Magnuson process rather than develop a new one. He told the council he'd prefer to go with the devil you know.
In essence, we're going to end up doing the same thing within the Magnuson Act that we're currently doing in our current process, which, while I don't think it's the perfect process, we've gotten pretty good at it.
With a presidential veto looming, council members did not offer any pushback against Oliver's plans to restore the NEPA process to Magnus and Stevens. However, they were more vocal about amendments proposed by Alaska Congressman Don Young to the bill, especially this language. Fisheries management is most effective when it incorporates information provided by governmental and non-governmental sources, including state and federal agency staff, fishermen, fishing communities, universities, and research institutions. This is just sort of a preamble. The deal breaker for the council comes next. As appropriate, such information should be considered the best scientific information available and form the basis of conservation and management measures as required by this act. Councilmember Duncan Fields from Kodiak suggested asking Congressman Young for clarification. How would traditional knowledge, or information accrued over generations by Alaska's natives, fare under this amendment?
It'd be hard for me to support a position for the council to say that sort of out of hand, we're not going to consider traditional knowledge, for example, relative to a particular issue in a particular context.
But it wasn't just a question of whether traditional knowledge might be discounted. It was also a question of whether the council would be compelled to consider any information available as the best science. This struck some members as intrusive. Council member Jim Balsiger is the regional director for NOAA Fisheries in Juneau.
This council has a long record of accepting information from everyone, and it needs to go through the SSC. So my whole thought on that was that allowing information from anyone outside the normal process raised questions.
The SSC is the council's scientific and statistical committee. Council Director Chris Oliver concurred he saw no harm to the council process if the language about best science were struck. He suspected that it originated in conflicts in the Gulf of Mexico, where there was greater distrust of government-sponsored science. The final recommendations from the council on changes to the Magnus and Stevens Act won't be made until another committee, the CCC, or Council Coordination Committee, meets later this month. Reporting from the North Pacific Fisheries Management Council meeting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Raven Alaska, providing business travel needs in over 100 communities across the state. Find more at flyraven.com. Alaska Pacific University offers an affordable education, small class sizes, and life-friendly schedules designed to support your personal and professional goals. APU is still accepting applications for fall 2015. Find out about financial aid and the Promise Tuition Grant and apply online at alaskapacific.edu before Saturday, August 1st. This message sponsored by Alaska Pacific University.
A dispute between two Sutton landowners highlights the challenges of zoning in the Matanuska-Susitna Borough. As KSKA's Ellen Lockyer reports, the borough's Board of Adjustment was called to weigh in on Wednesday on a clash between two legal but incompatible businesses.
A shooting range operating in Sutton has drawn criticism from an adjoining landowner. Chris Rose, who owns 20 acres in Sutton, says he has planned for years to use his land as a wedding event venue in partnership with an Anchorage florist.
Folks in Sutton are concerned, justifiably so, about protecting the investments in their properties. And that's why we have a Sutton Comprehensive Plan. That's why we have a special land use district. People like me rely on those things before we make investments in our property.
But about a year ago, Rose says he noted the sound of gunfire welling up over the bluff that separates his land from the Matanuska River. That sound was coming from a shooting range operated by Alaska Tactical on property owned by Anchorage brothers Jim and Tim Kane. The Kanes own JTAC, a business that they call a training facility that they run on their Sutton property. Tim Kane.
Well, JTAC doesn't do the training. We just provide a facility for anybody who needs an outdoor recreational area to provide whatever services they have as a business, and we lease the property to those people.
Kane says when JTAC opened, no borough permit was required.
We operated for two seasons and we didn't have any complaints. Nobody approached us. You know, we attended the Sutton Community Council meetings to keep them up to date.
But Alaska Tactical, a JTAC lessee, used the land for a private shooting range without a permit for a year and a half before anyone complained. That complaint prompted the Kanes to get a special use permit, which was approved by the Borough Planning Commission. And the Sutton Community Council weighed in favor of the permit, according to Community Council Communications Secretary Claudia Dolphy. Dolphy says that shooting is a Sutton pastime and that there are 14 private shooting ranges in the area.
At this point, having talked to neighbors and community members, it's been discussed that if we had an outdoor shooting range and an indoor shooting range, same location, we'd all purchase memberships. We wouldn't shoot on our property anymore. It's just more convenient. I think it would be a great advantage to our community.
Dolphy says the shooting range could lead to area jobs. But Rose appealed the Planning Commission's decision to the borough's Board of Adjustment. Rose says the shooting range violates the Sutton Comprehensive Use Plan.
I don't think anybody could have reasonably thought that the borough would allow a shooting range in a residential area, and that's really what this is all about. Particularly on the thin record that was presented to the Planning Commission in the first place.
In a judicial proceeding in Palmer on Wednesday, attorneys for the Kanes and Rose argued their cases. In the end, the three-member Board of Adjustment decided unanimously in favor of the Planning Commission's decision to issue the shooting range permit. Rose said Thursday that the shooting range permit is not based on substantial evidence, but he has not decided yet if he will appeal the board's decision. If he does, the case moves to state superior court. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Ketchikan's Volunteer Rescue Service recently added a new four-legged team member. Pace has a great nose, tons of energy, and the drive needed for what to her is a fun game. For the people she finds, though, it's as serious as life or death. KRBD's Layla Carey joined Ketchikan's rescue dog team for a morning of training and has this report.
Pace is ready to play fetch. To her, that's what a rescue is, but instead of tennis balls, she retrieves people. A volunteer is hiding among some shrubs on the other side of a large, soggy muskeg. Pace's owner and trainer, Carol Town, holds on to the trembling, whining Labrador retriever. Then Town lets Pace go. The whining stops, and the only sound is the tinkling of the bell attached to Pace's collar.
They better be ready.
A four-legged black streak zips across the muskeg, leaving behind a pack of clumsy humans trying hard but failing to keep up. Pace quickly finds the victim and rushes back to let Town know. Pace leads us to the victim, and her reward is a rousing game of what else? Fetch, this time with a favorite toy. Town has been training Pace since she was an eight-week-old puppy. Just recently, Pace passed her last level of certification. She's now officially the second certified search and rescue dog for the Ketchikan Volunteer Rescue Squad, a process that took about 2 years.
Well, as far as her testing, her first test was a trail test, and she did that last February. That's a half a mile test at night. A victim is hid on one side of the trail or the other, and she's excellent at that. She loves trails. And then we do the obedience, and that was our hard part because being named Pace, she can't stay still.
Levi, a black lab mix, had been the sole SAR dog. He's about 9 years old, which is close to retirement age. Levi's owner and trainer is Danelle Landis, the SAR dog team captain. She recently bought a young Belgian Malinois named Ripley and started training her to take over when Levi can't do the work anymore.
She's just finishing learning the whole runaway refined piece, which is the very end of the search. So we hold the dog, person runs away with the toy, then we let the dog go, they get to the person. When they get to the person, they run back and tell us by using an alert signal, which for her is a bark, which took me more than a month to teach her to bark on command.
Barking isn't the problem, of course. It's barking for a specific purpose that can be challenging. And then there's Boomer, a young, happy pit bull mix. He's a little further along in the training process, and he's going to rescue me from a different spot in that same muskeg.
And I'm hunkered down in a muskeg, surrounded by little shrubby trees, waiting for a dog to come find me. And I'm getting eaten by mosquitoes. I just got found.
For the dogs, searching is just plain fun. And despite the serious need for this kind of work, fun is part of the incentive for their handlers, too. They get to work with their dogs, hang out with other dog lovers, and after training is done for the day, they all have more fun with a group hike through the muskeg. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Layla Carey.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Matthew Smith in Nome, Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Ben Matheson in Bethel, Robert Woolsey in Sitka, Ellen Lockyer in the Mat-Su Valley, and Layla Carey in Ketchikan. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez reported from Juneau, and Liz Ruskin from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Monica Goki is our web producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
And by
Spinard Builder Supply. For more than 60 years, SBS has helped Alaskans build from ground to roof to everything in between. Spinard Builder Supply is here to build with you.
If you're ready to quit tobacco, Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line can help with free confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online. Now introducing Text to Quit, a way to help you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT now or visit alaskaquitline.com for more information. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.